Hello, this is The Link Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out, www.linuxshow.com, for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
Back. It's The Linux Show for the 28th of January, last week of the month, for the first month of 2003. We've gotten off to a good start this year so far. We're a little short-handed tonight, between people traveling and people down sick for the evening. Arnie, are you going to be able to make it through the show tonight?
We'll try our best.
Arnie, if you just can't do it, just say goodbye and hang up.
It's okay.
And we'll carry on without you the best we can.
I think I've got creeping Ganya. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's fatal or not. Maybe it's Ebola or something. I'm not sure.
Hope not. But for sure, Russ and Doc will probably not be with us. I know Russ won't. He is on a plane for Greece right now. Doc, his plane will be arriving to his destination really momentarily, so he may hook up with us during the second half of the show from the airport, like he does so many times. But we're going to carry on. We have a special guest with us tonight to pick up the slack left by Russ Pavlicek. We have invited a well-known Linux maven to join the show tonight on the regular panel, Joe Barr. So, hi, Joe Barr. How you doing?
Hi, everybody. How you doing? Arnie, you sound terrible.
I feel terrible, but that's okay. I think we'll make it.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll make it. The good side.
Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you very much. Even though we're shorthanded, I can talk an awful lot. That's
well, you know what? We know that. guess why you were invited. But, we're going to go ahead and carry on with our regular structure. Going to do a couple of quick maintenance announcements, and then we'll jump right into the first segment. First off, just to update everybody on the campaign for funding to keep the Linux Show continuing to operate in the air, we want to thank everybody who's been using the domain registration tool and recommending it to their friends. We have actually done pretty well, well enough to the point that I have talked to a couple of the Linux vendors about putting up some prizes, and we're actually going to run some kind of a contest in February or March dealing with the domain registration tool as a fundraiser for the Linux Show. So that's moving along very nicely. Thanks to everybody who has referred people to the domain registration tool, thank you ahead of time for your continued support. The announcement on the PayPal link was a little bit premature. We will not have the PayPal link up for those people who want to become direct subscriber supporters of the show. That will not be available till next week for the show, first show of February. But go ahead and jumping directly on into segment one, number one of the Linux Show, the hot news of the week. There's lots of it, so with no further ado, let's just jump right in there. Arnie, I want to give you the opportunity to go first, if you have anything prepared.
I've got all of my technical magazines in front of me, and I've been looking over them while I'm sitting here. Normally, I'm in my office and on the IRC channel when we're doing the show, and of course you called me up because I'm here in my bedroom with the extension, and so I've got a couple magazines here, and I can make some comments about it. Basically, I'm seeing a lot of articles on Linux in conjunction with Unix. Got people walking in and out of the room. Linux in conjunction with the innervating the Unix space, and that where Linux is doing big things is taking over for the older Unix installations. So companies like HP and the former Caldera, SCO, and others in the mainstream Unix space are probably feeling the heat more than, for instance, Microsoft. And that's probably true, I would think. But I think Microsoft is also feeling some of the market pressures from Linux, too, because of the cost. What I found interesting is in conjunction with the Linux World Expo, one of the things that they've been pointed out is, like, I don't think anybody missed the importance of the fact that the mainstream talks at the Linux World Expo were by mainstream financial community people. And that is
certainly big iron people.
Yeah, and I really, really do think that now, maybe what, a year, 2 years after the big IBM launch into the Linux world, well, it was almost 3 years now, I guess, that we are really seeing now the after effects of what IBM has done, and that really IBM has been very, very important in getting Linux into the mainstream and getting the big customers using Linux.
Yep.
I mean, Linux has always been in the back room, but now Linux is in the front room, and I think we have IBM to thank for that. IBM and their awesome, awesome, awesome program.
Well, I agree with both of your story comments. First of all, let's back up to the first one that you were talking about. And Joe and Kevin, feel free to jump in here too about the intrusion of Linux into the Unix space. I've been talking to a lot of people during the course of the last few days. Of course, the news story about how shall we put this relatively politely? The nonsense going over at SCO about the intellectual property of Unixware somehow gives them some form of intellectual property right to the Linux kernel. That, you know, that nonsense. I'm wondering, and some of the people I've been talking to last week are also wondering if the fact that the big numbers of replacements and upgrades on other Unixes, is in measure responsible for this response by SCO. That it's sort of a desperation looking for a way to make money kind of method to try and recoup lost market share. I really don't know, but
Jeff, have they said specifically that they're talking about things other than SCO Library?
Other than SCO Libraries, no. Dahl McBride, I've gotten him face to face three times and said, "Dahl, you keep on dancing around this. Look me square in the eyes and tell me, are you claiming intellectual property rights to Linux?" And all three times he's danced around it. And it's always, well, we're forming a new division. And, of course, recently the story has been they've actually formed that new division and they've staffed that new division. But it's always been our initial thrust will be the Unix libraries. But I don't know. Because of the fact that he never looked me square in the eyes and said, no, we're not claiming ownership of Linux, because of that,
It would be a grave mistake to do that.
Oh, boy, would it be a mistake.
I mean, this would be a grave, grave error and a total, total miscalculation.
And,
from a company, from a company who's been there in the Linux world, and now I believe, and I think this, let's make no pretenses now that SCO is not a Linux company.
Yeah. But,
period.
I mean, you gotta know that, what, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the company are telling Darryl not to do that. They're saying, you know, you're going to commit suicide by doing that. Because this would be the kind of case that would probably bring Linus out of his hands-off position that he takes in dealing with license with the GPL itself. And that would probably really force Linus to stand up and say something.
Well, I hope he doesn't have to, because
Linus
should really stay above the fray.
Yeah, well, I hope Darryl is sensible enough to realize how stupid that really would be for them to actually attempt to exercise that. It's just never gonna work.
I'm sorry, this is Bob breaking in. For those who don't have it, I can give the IP to attack. I assume you've mentioned that.
Oh, yeah. I don't have it. Or I didn't mention it. Boy, I am really negligent in my duties here. Let me break in for a moment for all of you people in the IRC. And, Kevin, could you pass this along to the people at the IRC? That the hack attack officially starts now and runs through the end of the show. We want anybody who can successfully hack through the server to do so. The IP number of the server is 24.99.38.85. Here are the rules. Number one is we ask you to not destroy the server, nor if you happen to penetrate and get to any systems behind the firewall, please don't be gentlemen and don't mess with those systems. We do want you to prove your success by either telling of the contents of one of the directories that you find, or you can flash something on one of the screens if you want to. What we would like you to do initially, if you do penetrate the server, is first email to staff, STAFF, at thelinuxshow.com. And if you can prove this, that you have penetrated, we will then email you a phone number of how you can get a hold of Bob and talk over with him about your penetration of their firewall.
Can I ask Bob one question?
Absolutely.
Bob, I don't want to give away too much here, but are you running MS SQL on your server?
Well, actually, no.
Okay.
No, I mean, there. You know, of course, there's out for what we have. Also, in each system under the etc under the slash root directory is a file called gold. If they can tell me the magic word in each one, I'll consider that proof that they've broken in.
Yep.
And of course, that file is only accessible by root.
Yep.
And we're seeing a whole bunch of folks trying.
There is a whole bunch of folks trying?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Email your hacker friends, people in IRC. All of our New Zealand friends down there, pass the word on to the eastern side of the globe and get some hacking going. The first person to successfully hack the server will get a boxed copy. This is a retail copy of Brew 17.0, the most recent version. It is the desktop version of it. It's not the big-ass commercial server version, but it's still usable on a server if you want to take the time to set it up. It's a pretty good product.
Excellent product.
It really is. Even the desktop version is really a competent server backup and restore tool, even though they don't sell it as such. So that's your prize if you should win. But let's go ahead and get back to the stories. Arnie, do you have any more?
Well, there was one other. There was one other thing in E-Week, their editorial this week, by Stan Gibson, who's a Linux friend, by the way, has an editorial name, let's see, on page, this is on page 7, so like it's right on the contents page. Everybody wants to be seen with the Penguin. E-Week will do a $4 billion of Linux business this year. Hey, only kidding, but who would ever know? No one checks out these claims, and if they did, would you believe them if they used general accepted accounting principles? I didn't think so. So Kelly Fiorina is free to trumpet the HP's $2 billion in Linux business to trump IBM's paltry $1 billion, announced by IBM software head Steve Mills at Linux World last year. Everybody wants to be seen with the Penguin on his or her arm, who is really making a commitment. Dollar debates are distracting disservice compared with development tools. As Dell K. Taft reports on page 1 this week, SUSE is set to bundle IBM's open source Eclipse integrated, blah, 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 blah. And he goes on.
Yep.
Well, and it's interesting little take on things.
He's right. I said that last week, that I thought that the 2 billion numbers out of HP were exaggerated.
Now, he goes on here. Even Microsoft is making nice. While not yet porting Office to Linux, the company was at Linux World and wasn't toting funny-smelling market studies proving Windows is cheaper. Still far from a commitment, but in a year, who knows? It was a year ago that Microsoft announced the Trustworthy Corp Competing Initiative. What was talk then is now action, as Dennis Fisher reports on page 1, blah, blah, blah. Dennis gets inside Microsoft to reveal company is ready to fire programmers if the code has holes. If Windows Server 2003 stands up, we'll know the plan worked. Interesting take. Microsoft wants to fire people for making mistakes in the code. You know, that's one thing that will just drive the programmers into the Linux side, because you know what? That's one thing nice about Linux. You don't get fired. You don't lose your job because you made a mistake. Mistakes are part of the process here, and when you make a mistake, you fix the mistake and move on. Yeah, I think that's a little heavy-handed on Microsoft.
Yep. But on the other hand, they suffered a great injury during the last 5 days.
Yeah.
It has been a difficult week for Microsoft.
Maybe that'll be some of the stories we talk about this week then.
Yeah. But
I haven't heard too much about what happened.
Everybody can jump in on this one. I've got a link on our website.
You're looking for that link, Jeff. The thing that impressed me the most about, I don't want to do much Microsoft bashing about this Microsoft problem, was that it shut down Microsoft. And it shut them down to the point that customers couldn't even get the patches.
Right.
And their internal network was infected with the very thing that was causing everybody else grief.
Yep. And
it was infected because the patch process is much more difficult than Microsoft would have us believe.
Exactly. That has been the real lesson right there, is that the ugly secret about Microsoft's patch process, the actual procedural process, is incredibly flawed. And that is now out of the closet, staring the entire world in the face.
And that gives WCAG a very big bone to chew on for a week or so, because their first line of defense for years has always been stupid users not applying patches.
Yep.
And it's going to be hard for them to use that next week.
It certainly will be. But
you know, it's not as, and you know, the mirror, for instance, take a system like the one I'm using right now, and I know that SUSE's is similar, and so is Red Hat's. And the fact is, in the open source community, because open software, and this is a really big advantage for open software, is that because open software does not rely on the monolithic single source for the patches, if when I have a security alert, and I get them all the time, Debian is very good at releasing security alerts, I can apt-get to the Debian server within 2 minutes, my system is fixed. Period. And at any time of the day or night. Now, if the Debian server is down by some, for whatever reason, there are any number of Debian mirrors all over the world which have the bona fide exact same thing. And I can just point apt to virtually any one of them and get the upgrade that way. And it just literally takes seconds.
Well, according to CNN, the blame game is now going hard and heavy on Flammerworm. And most of the IT directors, in particular, people who happen to own chains of banks and ATM networks who are not offline, are specifically pointing the finger at Microsoft in two different areas. Number one, the admins, for what Joe said just a minute ago, the fact that they didn't even apply the patches themselves, so people who were caught with their pants down couldn't do anything about it. But realistically, the software designers created a flawed system that was just too difficult, too expensive for administrators to keep up with on a regular basis. And the net result of this, in Bill Gates' own accounting, has caused $455 million worth of losses over the last 5 days to businesses around the world. My gut tells me it's probably a much bigger price tag than that.
It's $500 million.
Yep. It's $500 million.
We need to throw that into somebody's TCO, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's probably not in the TCO template they used to prove Windows was cheaper than Linux.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Let's keep that in mind for future reference. Add one portion of that $455 million in there. But the net result of this is people are already flocking away. I mean, the stories are just really pandemic. If you go to literally any business website, there's stories about major corporate IT directors have really, finally, this has been the last straw. They've had it. And even within our own government, the new Bureau of Internal Defense, our Home Defense Bureau, has already announced that they're converting everything to open source, that they cannot afford for their networks to go down for 5 days during a crisis. It's just intolerable. So this is going to be difficult next couple of weeks for them to continue business as usual. So, Joe, I know you got a bunch of stories that you want to cover. Do you want to do a couple of them?
I do have several things. I've got a lot, not a lot, I've got a couple of things I'd like to sneak in but not talk about for very long because they're not on the link list.
That doesn't matter.
Okay.
Does not matter.
Open Projects is for sale on eBay.
I've heard about that.
Okay. That startled me. I don't know if that's a news story either.
Well, what's the buzz?
Well, I think it's just and attempt to raise cash. The bid I saw was a $5,000 opening bid. Maybe that's for the starting point. But it said the reserve had not been met. And this is for openprojects.com.net.org. Because they've changed the name now to, or they're using a different network now, Freenode, freenodes.net,
mm-hmm.
for the IRC, for all these wonderful IRC support channels for just about every distribution and a lot of different projects and a lot of different activities going on. It's my favorite IRC place to go, to tell you the truth. But they're chronically short of money, and I guess this is another way to raise money.
Is this the former Open Projects themselves selling them, or is this a squatter?
No, this is the former Open Projects guy himself.
Oh, okay.
It's Rob Levin.
That's an interesting way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And more power to him if he can get some money. These are tough times for lots of people.
Yeah, for all of us.
Yes, exactly. Especially in the world of techno journalism.
Yeah. Hey, we're trying to stay alive with doing domain registries.
Yeah, that's great.
I registered 3 domain names today with the IBS.
And Joe, you know what? I saw them go through, and
you
I did thank
not.
You.
Oh wow, great. The Linux Desktop Summit is now known as the Desktop Linux Summit. Many of the players are new. Many of the players remain. I queried Sun today if they were still going to attend, but I didn't get a response before showtime.
Is there a new URL?
Yes, and the new URL is Desktop Linux Summit.
That's the name of Lindo's product, isn't it, Desktop Linux?
I am not sure. I'm not sure. Lindo's is neither the PR manager nor Michael Robertson.
Yeah,
is returning my queries, so I'm in the dark.
Really?
Yeah. They seem to prefer to talk to people that don't know anything about Linux. Is that true? Is that a fair observation?
That is a fact.
Yeah, because they don't like the Linux Peak crowd, because the Linux crowd is kind of upset with their complete and utter stupidity.
Right.
Yeah. Joe, it's been so bad with them not only not being, you know, free with information when legitimate questions have been asked, but they've been downright rude in their treatment of many of the people in the IT press. They want the IT press that's only on the periphery of the IT press, that's not smart enough to ask any real technical questions, because all they really want to focus on is Windows versus Microsoft. That's all they want to talk about.
Right. Well, they can ride that. They can ride that horse a long way. It's not a bad business plan on the positive side, but it's got a tremendous downside to it, and I'm not sure they're aware of what they're creating for themselves, because the sort of animosity that's building up around them is going to take them down.
Well, they're certainly not going to get much support from the open source community.
Right.
Yeah,
because I tell you right now, I won't do anything to comfort them.
Right.
Not as long as they don't play by the rules.
Well, Mr. Robertson is invited to join us on February the 25th. We have had a trading of emails during the course of the last month, although I haven't heard from him recently. I am anticipating. He said he was going to come initially. But that was, of course, before the crapola hit the fan.
Right.
And things really, really turned ugly. I sort of hit on this and missed on this. I did make a prediction that they would have to change the name of the event.
Dead right.
But I didn't think that. I thought they would just be totally honest. I was hoping they would be totally honest and just call it the Windows Partners Summit.
Right.
That would have been honest and actually a very positive thing to do for them.
But even desktop Linux is better than leaving it the way it was.
I agree.
Because at least it's the name of their product.
I agree. Well, my other stories, you've touched on a couple of them, and it's interesting because we all seem to be in agreement on these.
Well, let's hash them out a little bit more because we just covered them in general.
The story from digitalmass.boston.com, that's the Boston paper.
Boston Globe.
Yeah, the Boston Globe, where it says HP says it now gets $2 billion of sales from Linux. And, of course, that announcement wasn't made in the country, and it wasn't made in Linux World, but in Europe, where Carly was giving a talk to, I guess, a group of IT managers or somebody. I was stunned by that claim, and I had this nagging suspicion that it could not possibly be true. It reminded me of the days when 3 years ago when there were dollar bills, $100 bills, $1,000 bills just sprinkling down on the Linux crowd from up above. And there was more money than anyone ever possibly dreamed of coming to Linux. And there were impossible IPO launches.
Billion-dollar purchases of flash stock.
Exactly. And this talk sort of scares me a little bit. I can't imagine that it's true. Maybe it is. I don't know. But I'm very, very cautious about it. And I think, Jeff, I think I heard you saying that I'm not alone in that.
Not at all. No, I have an unconfirmed source. I've been trying to get another source to confirm this, but has been telling me for the better part of 6 months that eventually we will hear an announcement out of the new HP/Compaq, all of a sudden bringing about enormous sales in Linux. And I was told that to have a heads up about this because there is a method internally where they play with the numbers, and any system that's sold without an operating system on it, they feel free to allocate that anywhere they want to.
Right.
And a month later, they may reallocate it to a different thing.
Yeah.
And so when they're talking before a big group of Microsoft people, that $2 billion worth of hardware is probably 90% Windows. When they're talking to the SCO crowd, it's Unixware. When they're talking to the Linux press, it's $2 billion worth of Linux. I say, show me the paper.
Right.
Although, prove it.
When I spoke to Bruce Perrins two or three weeks ago, I was talking to him for an interview we did at Linux World. He did say that HP has secretly been selling preloaded Linux in China for about a year.
It's not a secret.
It was a secret to me.
No, it's not. No.
And he referred to it as being secret, but if it's known, I just didn't know about it.
Yep.
He said they kept it quiet because they're afraid it's just being replaced with pirated copies of Windows. And of course, that's one of the things that Microsoft has been claiming all along, is any PC sold without an OS on it is just a home for pirated Windows.
That's a shameless slam. Microsoft knows that knows the truth. It just suits themselves. It suits their agenda to basically block everybody else from using anything else but Windows. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, this is the same bloody excuse and same bloody argument they've used all along for their to get their exclusionary licenses.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my second story is also something of a stunner for me, and it was the announcement from the Department of Homeland Security that they were switching from Windows 2000 to Linux, and that was the story that was on NewsForge. I'm not a big fan of government IT people. I don't hold them in high regard. I think this is a wonderful move. I think it's a very wise move. I just don't know how they came up making that decision. Maybe I don't give the guys in the trenches enough credit for knowing operating systems and operating system vulnerabilities. Maybe I don't give their admins and their IT management enough credit. I've just seen so many politicians who give the dollars to the lobbyists who, and wave at whoever the lobbyists say to wave at. I've seen so much of that that I don't have a very high regard for governmental computing knowledge at all.
But down at the bottom level where this is, where Linux is going to be used, it's no different than the bottom level of any company. Linux has been working in corporate America for years and years and years, and it gets in through the back door. I mean, if the Department of Homeland Security is decided to move from Windows 2000 to Linux, it has to be, by default, it has to be true that they have been using Linux all along. And, of course, how could that be any way else? I mean, Linux has probably been there all along.
That's true, but there was no Homeland Security Department 6 months ago, so...
It wasn't 6 weeks ago either.
Yeah. But
part of it is that, you know, a lot of times, the way Linux originally got in a lot of the corporate environments, you know, they were, you know, Windows shops, but, you know, the sysadmins just said, let's try this and see how this works.
Right.
And certainly for high visibility situations, where you really have to have security, I think they've decided to get more realistic. You know, the technical people know that Linux is far more secure if you do a little bit of hardening. And, you know, if Homeland Security system starts getting broken into, you know, right off the bat, then that's going to, like, put a damper on what happens with them, and Congress will just yank their charter.
My friends who know Windows and know Windows security have told me that Windows 2000 is pretty good, and that a good admin can make it pretty secure. So in moving from that Windows platform to Linux, I think it's the highest compliment for Linux and open source that the government could possibly make.
I think Windows 2000 and some later version of Windows are certainly more secure than what's come before, but I still think there is quite a depth, you know, between their security and something that, you know, has security designed in. I mean,
let me give you some information there, because I know some very good Windows admins. The college I teach at has some very good Windows MCSE, senior MCSE guys, okay? They can make a Windows 2000 server extremely secure as best as they possibly can based upon the information that Microsoft gives them. And there's the fundamental difference, is they are relying upon information from Microsoft.
Well, the
Microsoft doesn't tell everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing,
and
with
that's
Windows.
That's a fundamental difference.
There's another thing with Windows.
It's open source, you know everything.
There's another thing with Windows, and that is the client side is where the exploits come in. The client software is insecure to the point that the lack of good security design in the Windows platform itself is exposed, because they get in through the client, and the client allows them to get in to the administration capabilities.
Yeah, you don't have the walls between different accounts like you do in Linux. I mean, even if NameD gets compromised, if you set up a modern Linux system, it's not running as root. It's running as a user that's not used for anything else, so you can't do anything other than bother the, you know, NameD, and you can't then attack SendMail or your web server.
That's
or
right.
Whatnot. The other problem is that, quite frankly, in my opinion, there's so darn many bugs in Windows that, you know, you've got to be patching the stuff like every day, and there's still going to be a window vulnerability. In Linux, the way it's commonly used, typically for, you know, servers where you really care about security, there aren't that many bugs. I mean, there's a major bug in you know, Apache on the average about once every 5 years. And even on the things that it depends on, there just aren't very many bugs. So there's less of a window of vulnerability.
I wonder if they're using that NSA Linux.
They may even be using that. I mean, you know, that's basically multi-level security. You know, Orange Book, I believe it's C2. It's good stuff. I mean, I've worked on Unixes that that helped develop them that use that. It's good stuff.
Well, it's a very positive occurrence, and coupled with the bad news from Microsoft in this huge embarrassment with the SQL Slammer and their own problems in coping with it, this has been a really bad week for them on the server. And my last story is going to just kill them. I love this story. It's from the geek himself, Mr. Torvalds in Australia. And by the way, why were Alan Cox and Linus Torvalds in Australia for a 300 or 400 developer conference rather than at Linux World?
Oh, I know exactly the reason for that. It's very simple. Both Linus and Alan have the same basic philosophy on conferences. They don't like going to the same conference twice. And they will go to an event that's a tiny little event. I mean, several years ago, Linus came out to Fermi Laboratories and gave a presentation at Fermi Laboratories. And he will do that if somebody's paying for him to go somewhere to basically give him a free vacation to a place where his family has never been before. Bottom line, he's been to New York 3 or 4 times already. He could give a damn.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with he doesn't really want to be at the conference.
This is the first Linux World Expo he's missed. But he's just right.
He just doesn't like going to the same place too many times.
Right.
It's a vacation issue. He works for Transmeta, not for the Linux community. And
well, I think maybe there's just too many suits there now.
Yep.
It's a very suit-rich environment.
Yep.
And maybe I'll say that just because I don't get to go very often anymore, but I really enjoyed it when I did go, and it had a very high geek ratio. It's just a fun place to walk around.
I
wonder, were the geeks sitting around in inflatable chairs at the OSDN booth? I mean, you know.
Well, I go back to when I interviewed Richard Stallman sitting on plastic inflated air sofa.
Yeah.
In the .org pavilion, and I could barely.
That was 1999.
I was afraid I'd slide off in front or slide.
That was in San Jose.
Right.
That was 1999.
That was a good one. The Linux show had a prominent booth in that show.
Yep. You guys were on the air.
That's why people paid us to do things, Arnie.
Yeah. You guys are sitting there. That was just before I became associated with the Linux show, and you guys were sharing a booth, Linux Journal.
But anyway, the quote in the story about Torvalds in Australia that struck me is this, and I'll just read it.
We got a link to that on our website called Random Linux Sightings.
Right, so, correct.
Do we want to start talking about the adaptive firewalls and all?
In just a few minutes.
Okay.
I'll wrap this up real quickly. One of the things that's probably going to start happening this year, this is Linus's words, or start happening in a much bigger way, is Linux on the desktop.
He's never said anything like that before.
No, he hasn't. And it looks like the servers are ours. And the march isn't over yet. And that's pretty much what I've got. And thank you very much, Jeff, for having me on the show. I've enjoyed it.
Well, hang out and stick with us for the second half of the show. Real quick, I just want to talk real quick about a couple stories just to point people at the links. I will talk about the Red Hat end of life errata story next week, because I think this is one that really does need to have a few minutes spent on. It really sort of irritates me. I can understand Red Hat's need for doing it, but it still irritates me. And in particular, a thread that I've been following for the past 4 weeks, there's a link on the site called Positive IT News Gains Momentum, and what that story is in reference to is Xerox Corporation. I've been trying to bring to everybody's attention that if you're familiar with the metrics of the way the IT industry works, things are really starting to look better. The economy still sucks, but there's really good, solid, positive news out there. In particular, this week, the thing I'm focusing on is Xerox Corporation is a strong bellwether for improvements in IT. And Xerox made money this last quarter. They haven't made money in a while. And so this was a real shock to Wall Street. And it does indicate good things. But we're going to go ahead and check out of here for a couple minutes. Kevin, take us out with a tune. We'll take a real short break. We're going to come back with segment number two with Bob Toxin from Fly By Day Consulting. We're going to be talking about their very secure servers using adaptive firewall technology.
Will he explain to me what an adaptive firewall is?
Yeah, he will after good. The break. And what is the product called? Cracker Trap. It's
I love
really
that.
Easy to say that wrong.
I love that name.
Great.
Yeah. And by the way, before we jump off of the break, Bob, any penetrations yet?
Not that I can see. So people are sort of trying. I think they've slowed down. I think they've given up. The Cracker Traps caught quite a few people.
Okay. Come on, you guys. Let's go. Pick up the pace. Let's try and see if we can take the server out. Everybody hang in there. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. This is the Linux Show for January the 28th, 2003. We'll be right back.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
Every day I wake up hoping the answer will come to me. Sometimes it gets so confusing, I just go back to sleep. Later on, my mother told from a job that I never liked in the first place. 4 years of my life gone by, and this is the thanks I get. Feels like I've been dumped by a girl and I never really learned anyway. Again, so I just keep taking my time again. and what went wrong. No easy answers as I watch the rain come pouring down.
This is The Linux Show, part two of tonight's episode of The Linux Show. Segment number two, we're covering the Son of Hack Attack. This segment was originally intended to be done, sometime along the lines of January 7th or sometime around the first week of January. And because of technical difficulties, we were unable to bring you this Hack Attack segment and bring you Bob Toxin of Fly By Day Consulting to talk about adaptive firewall. So, okay, Bob, how have things been going?
A lot of people have been trying. As far as I can tell, nobody succeeded. I'll certainly be running my uncracked utility when we're done, which basically compares everything on the disk to what it should be, and if anybody's left a Trojan behind, it should be found. I should also note that the problem before was shortly before the show when I was working to secure my system. One thing I was doing was disconnecting a disk that had some confidential data in it, and I hadn't realized I'd bumped my Ethernet card loose, so I didn't have an Ethernet card to get to the network, so I apologize for that.
Well, that does make it more secure.
Who was it that said the most secure network is the one that's not connected?
Well, I do recommend both in my book and elsewhere that for there's certain applications that are just, the information's just so confidential, you just, you know, you'd be crazy to put them on the Internet. And I took great pleasure in mentioning one such application was the state of California having their entire state employee database accessible online. And somebody broke in from Massachusetts and collected all the information, all the personal data for everybody from the governor on down and, you know, undercover police, you know, officers and all kinds of people that would really rather not have their home address and perhaps their bank accounts revealed.
Yep. I have a tendency of trying to get my customers to do that with their accounting systems, to just yank the cable out of the wall and isolate those systems from the rest of their network. It really is the only good solution. But, at least so far, it seems your adaptive firewall is holding up tonight.
It seems to be. I mean, you know, I can't discount the possibility somebody might have snuck in, although the rules of the game is that they have to admit it, and they also have to find, you know, the contents of the file /root/gold on both my server and on at least one other client-side system, one desktop system, at least one that I've left on the network for their fun.
Yep, because I'm getting email from people listening,
mm-hmm.
and I'm getting email. Now, I haven't been looking at the IRC.
I just saw something on the IRC, a comment from Stock. He said, I only have respect for this firewall. Evidently, he's been trying to get in.
Mm-hmm.
If the owner can still access his machine from the Internet.
I certainly can. I mean, I've left SSH open.
I'll tell him that.
Well, there you go, Stock.
There you go, Stock, yeah. Oh, Bob, why don't you start off by giving us all a big an overview of exactly what adaptive firewall is and where you see it positioning in the market.
Yeah, what does it mean?
Okay, well, it's an idea I certainly didn't come up with. It's been around now for, I think, about 4 years. Problem is before that, I mean, everybody knows with firewall, you know, you want to block port 1434 and, you know, anything else that internal systems might accidentally leave open that you really don't want people on the Internet to get at. 1434, of course, is the Microsoft SQL port that has been news lately. Problem is that somebody will just run an nmap scan, and they'll see port 1434, or if you don't have it, they'll just go try another port. They'll try port 80 for the web server, whatnot. And they're just free to keep trying ports and different IPs, you know, your public IPs for your systems on the DMZ, until they break in. I mean, and, you know, on a large network, there's going to be something open and something you haven't allowed for. So they can just keep on banging on it. The concept behind an adaptive firewall is you watch what they're doing. If they do something they're not supposed to do, you just lock that IP out of the entire network. So
sort
I have
like,
that rigged
sort of
like
on... Port Sentry?
What's that?
Sort of like Port Sentry?
Right. Port Sentry is a good example where it will... You can have it either listen on particular ports. You know, if you don't have a web server on a particular machine, on machine A, you have it listen to, you know, port 80 on that machine. Maybe that's your mail server. And, you know, then on system B, which is your web server, you have it listen on port 25. So if they guess wrong, they get locked out. Port Sentry is very good at this. My technique's a little bit smarter. I mean, Port Sentry, by default, it'll generate email and keep on going. I really want to also get paged. You know, my software, it'll page me for it. You can tell it systems that you trust. Unlike Port Sentry, if you tell it you trust a system, it won't tell you if that system's doing something wrong. So if that system gets compromised or if somebody in that system is doing something suspicious, with Port Sentry you won't know it. With mine, it'll still generate the page and the email. It just won't lock that system out. But it's pretty much the same concept.
So, in other words, if an IP number of a disgruntled employee is trying to mess with things, this technology will at least forewarn you that something ugly is about to happen.
Absolutely. I also go a little bit beyond Port Sentry. Port Sentry can only do it by particular port number, and it can only do it on the firewall itself. What I've done is I set up so with a cracker trap, which is basically my trademark name for my adaptive firewall, you can also monitor every public IP or, for that matter, every private IP as well. And so if somebody, say, you know, hits one of these other servers, you know, your DMZ from the firewall, you can block their access to the whole network. With Port Sentry, you'd have to run it on each of these systems. They'd each have to be Linux or I believe Unix, and if they, you know, if Port Sentry one of them gets trapped, they can still attack the other systems by centralizing, you know, my technique on the firewall. They get locked out of everything. And
well, that's the whole purpose of a firewall is to provide a pinch point through which you can control access.
Absolutely.
And if you have to go and put all this software on your internal machines on the other side of the firewall, it's not being very good, is it?
Right. Well, that's kind of the limits of Port Sentry. Also, the fact that, you know, with the standard firewall, it doesn't see that somebody's trying to attack and lock them out. Because I also can put, you know, use, you know, TCP wrappers to say only let certain systems use SSH. If anybody else uses SSH, even though SSH is an allowed service for some people, those other people get locked out, which is why everybody who's trying to get in through SSH is getting locked out in short order. Unless they can do it from, you know, the few systems on the internet they allow access to.
Right.
Very interesting.
That's a good idea, actually.
It's a wonderful idea, because I can tell you from monitoring many clients that the first thing people try is SSH. I mean, that, HTTP, HTTPS, and send, and, you know, mail port, SMTP. Those are some of
them. Don't forget the FTP.
FTP and, you know, Windows ports.
Yeah, the FTP is probably the biggest vulnerability in Unix. Anybody runs FTP.
So how much does it cost to actually deploy Cracker Trap?
If you buy my book, anybody who buys a book's allowed to use it.
Real World Linux Security,
right.
Second Edition.
Right.
Just by buying the book, that gives you a license to Cracker Trap.
Exactly.
Pretty good deal.
Very good deal.
There's quite a, and it comes with a companion CD, so you don't even have to key it in. There's actually quite a bit of neat stuff like that. I've done some major enhancements to LogCheck so that it, too, can be used to page you as well as generate email.
Mm-hmm.
It also, the version I have, which is GPL, of course, it generates, you know, most of the entries are a single line, which makes it much easier to read. And it does a few other things to, you know, massage the logs to be easier to read. So, you know, there's quite a good software on the CD. Of course, a few things like, you know, my enhancements to LogCheck, you know, are GPL'd.
Do you have a website, Bob?
Yes, www.verysecurelinux.com.
Hmm. And I presume you can get the book at Barnes & Noble?
It's pretty much everywhere. Barnes & Noble, Borders,
Book
Amazon,
Bookpool.
You can order directly from the publisher.
That's fine. Just don't say the A word here.
I'm sorry?
Don't say the A word here.
Yeah, we don't promote the other company.
I don't know who you're referring to, so I certainly won't say it.
Well, I certainly don't know who.
Oh, the A word. Yeah, they've selling used books alongside new books. They've lost their love from any author and publisher, unfortunately.
Yep. Well, very interesting. Are people still hacking?
Oh, yeah. We just saw some new folks come in. Interesting.
It looks like a lot of them are hitting that FSH trap and being vaporized.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the first, yeah. I saw that as soon as I said, okay, we have SSH open, so everybody hit it. I didn't tell them that only from certain systems anybody else gets locked out. You know, the good people will do better scans and we'll be able to, you know, figure that out. But one of the other tricks that I just do is standard firewall technique. If somebody hits something that's not allowed, I don't do them the courtesy to send them a packet back. It just, nothing comes back.
Bob, is your background a black hat or a white hat? Gray hat.
I would say gray hat being, you know, very close to white. The only systems I've attacked without permission were those at University of California, Berkeley, when I was a student.
That's
almost a requirement, I think.
Yeah, when you're young and foolish,
yeah.
You seem to do things like that.
And at college, it's all fair.
Well, Berkeley, it's even more interesting because it's being a state college, of course, you know, the education and research systems and all that are pretty much supposed to be open to everybody, but they had a rather draconian system administrator who actually seems to have vanished lately but was rather well known in the early Unix days. It's just a general university attitude of, you know, professors are gods and grad students are their, their priests.
Acolytes,
and
yeah.
Undergrads were basically, you know, what you swept off the floor, you know. And so, you know, I wanted to do research on the system. They wouldn't let me. I wanted to hack on the kernel and add features and things like that, and I wasn't allowed to. So I broke into the main research system, the Coit Hall system, and started making enhancements.
Yep.
Yeah, well, you were forced to it.
Well, I can't say that. I mean, what I did was probably illegal. So, you know, saying that you're being forced to do something illegal, I can't justify that.
Well,
it was certainly, their attitude was unfair at the very least.
Well, I tell you, I would never admit to some of the things that I did when I was young and foolish, that's for sure. Of course, the systems were a lot easier to get into back then. They were completely unsecured back in those days.
Well, this system actually was rather well secured. I mean, you know, even today, you wouldn't have just walked in the system and gotten in. You know, the people involved in it, one of the grad students who helped, you know, tweak and so forth is somebody named Bill Joy, who, of course, you know, the technical genius behind Sun, or, you know, the initial, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, back in 1978, I got into Dow Jones mainframe by accident.
By accident.
By accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, we believe that.
Yeah, I believe that.
Well, we have
accident. Uh-huh.
we actually broke into one of our systems because, you know, they got a new box, new PDP 11, and they didn't want to go through all the trouble of doing a complete install, so they just duplicated the disks from the Corey Hall system, not knowing we'd already broken into it.
Oh, no.
So we just, you know, one of us just tried to get into that with one of our, you know, holes, and lo and behold, it worked just fine.
I'll be darned.
Well, we are up to the time. Bob, I want to thank you for coming back the third time. We finally got it done. I appreciate it. Please keep in touch with us as the product develops. I'm going to have to get a copy of the book so I can...
You've sold at least two books then, because I'm going to pick one up too.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get one too.
There you go. $3, see?
Hey, you've made your money tonight.
And I'm sure you got some Me Toos in the RC channel, all of them that on RC today.
Well, I think there's some of them who tried to get in want to know, you know, okay, how did I get locked out so fast?
Maybe you can get into IRC and talk to them a little bit.
Yeah, if you've got IRC client running, we'd like you to do that because the people will hang around for about half an hour after the show is over. Do have a couple announcements I do need to sneak in about some of the things that are up and coming. First of all, there will be a... announcement made probably on next week's show about a project that I've been talking about now for the better part of 6 weeks. The official press releases for Radio Free Universe finally come out next week. I actually spent the better part of the day drafting the final version of the press releases. For those of you who are not regular listeners and don't know what Radio Free Universe is it's a response by the Linux Show, Radio Paradise, a number of other people who are doing webcasting. It's our response to both the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the Disney extension to copyrights, as well as the rather usurious regulatory process that has been laid upon us in the webcasting industry by CARP, the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel. The Radio Free Universe project is a four-prong approach to building not only streaming technology, that's the first part of it. Second part of it is tools to do actual programming and content planning, such as queuing up music, building music libraries, digital versions of analog phone hybrids, things like that, tools that are needed by radio stations, whether they're webcasters or broadcasters. Third part of it is compliance tools. We're stuck with these stupid laws and regulations, so we're taking the information from the tool, that's the programming tool, to create a database that prepares the compliance data that the RIAA has convinced the government is needed. And the fourth part of the project is to encourage artists to release royalty-free music. Well, that project has been moving forward slowly in fits and starts. There's really a remarkable amount of work that has been done on it based upon the fits and starts that it has. But next week we're going to be making the official announcement. There will be a website. It'll probably get blogged by half of the blogger community next week. What we're going to be doing is looking for programmers to participate in the project, and hell, even if you're not a programmer, you can get involved in the process just by contacting artists and getting the information that we've prepared into the hands of artists so that they understand there's real financial gain to them to joining with us and participating in this alternative broadcast technology that's different from the mainstream. So come back next week and help us out. If you know people who are who are interested in webcasting or music, for that matter, please make sure you do stop by next week's show and pick up on the announcement of the Radio Free Universe launch. And we'll take it from there. But on behalf of everybody, we'd like to thank our guest, Bob Toxin. I got to thank our other guest, Joe Barr. Joe, thanks for coming by tonight.
Thank you.
And,
my pleasure.
And filling in for us. And so on behalf of all of us regulars, this has been the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for the 28th of January, 2003. We will be back the same time next week. Make sure you tell 10 friends about the Linux Show and tell your friends while you're telling them about the show. Have them register a domain that puts a buck and a half into the coffers of the Linux Show's operating budget.
Before we go, they can reach Bob at book at verysecurelinux.com. I don't have IRC set up.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure.
So, everybody, we're out of here.
Night.
So you need
night.
An email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? No, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.